Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 199, which means we are only one episode away from the 200th episode, and I am very excited about that one. There is going to be a special announcement for that one, so look forward to that next week. But for this episode 199 is going to be an amazing discussion that I had over at THU, Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn, that took place in Malta this year, 2018. I was doing several panels. As you guys know, I already released one of those panel discussions on the subject of tools in terms of technology and creativity. But this particular episode is about human representation, digital humans and otherwise. And it was a really, really great episode. And I had an all-star panel, seriously an all-star panel that I recorded in Malta. And really, really incredible people. So the guests are as follows. Ian Spriggs. A lot of you guys know who Ian Spriggs is. Henry calls him the digital Rembrandt. He does incredible human portraiture and really thinks about digital humans and representation, both in CG and in painting, and does an incredible job at that. The other person that was also involved was Paul Debevic. I mean, seriously, Paul Debevic knows an incredible amount in terms of the science of creating digital humans in CG and has done incredible research in that area, both at ICT and at Google. And then we also had Hal Hickel. He's an animation supervisor over at ILM. There's actually, I just released another podcast with Hal before, but he has an incredible discussion about the role that digital humans have in filmmaking. And we talked about a lot about his work in Rogue One and the ethics of digital humans. And it was really, really great to have his point of view on that. Scott Eaton was also involved. He's actually, all of these people so far have been previous guests on the podcast, but Scott really understands an enormous amount about digital humans, especially in the world of anatomy, and is doing enormous amount of research in AI. And he's actually going to be on another one of my panels that I did at THU as well. So that, look forward to that one. But Scott was a great addition to this one. And last but not least is Frank Zhang, who I've been wanting to talk to on the podcast for a long time, but I've known him for several years. He's actually he was a THU attendee in the past. And Frank is one of the lead character artists over at Naughty Dog. And if you guys know who Naughty Dog is, Naughty Dog is one of the leading, most interesting game companies. And so he really brings the perspective of bringing digital humans to games and what that really means. We had an incredible discussion about digital humans and representation of humans, the uncanny valley, the ethics of digital humans, the role that AI has to play in this whole field and where we're going in the future. So it was a really fantastic talk, and I really appreciate all the people that were able to come to this event and actually participate. There's a lot of audience because it was done in front of a panel, so there's a lot of audience participation as well, and that's what I always expect from THU, people to really get involved in that. And fantastic questions. So I really appreciate the audience sort of being involved and bringing up some incredible subjects. I love the subject of digital humans. It fascinates me, so I really appreciate having done this. In terms of announcements right now, we're sort of in a period where there's a lot of stuff going on, but we're sort of trying to wrap up a bunch of things for the new year. If you guys don't know, V-Ray Next for Maya is out. It's now a product, so you guys should definitely check that out. I have been writing some blog posts on that, so if you want to know some of the new features that are coming out, V-Ray Next for Maya, definitely go to chaosgroup.com and check that out. V-Ray for Unreal is also out at this point. It is a product for, you know, full product, so you guys can purchase that and get to know how the world of V-Ray can fit with the world of real-time inside of the Unreal Engine. So really fun to be able to get that product out there, because I really had a lot of fun with that. And I think that's all I got for announcements right now. Hopefully you guys will enjoy this awesome podcast number 199 that was recorded at THU in Malta. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell. You need to make sure everything has Fernell.
Hello. Thank you guys so much for coming. Thank you. All right. How many of you guys were here yesterday? Oh, okay. Did you guys coming back because yesterday was awesome? I've been nervous because this is like this little room tucked away, and I don't know if everyone knows of like the secret room, but everyone's showing up. This is awesome. And considering the fact that it's been raining, I'm so glad that everyone's here, and it's really appreciated. So just for those of you who haven't been here, so this is a new kind of talk that Andre has. You know, Andre always has these crazy ideas. And the idea behind this is that we want to start to think about technology at THU. THU has been purposefully, in the past, purposefully sort of excluded in part of THU because it needs to be about the artists and about them. But technology plays an important part in an artist in what they do. So I really wanted to make sure that people were able to see technology from a new perspective. I think if you go to things like SIGGRAPH, which is Paul is a big member of SIGGRAPH, that is more presented to people who make technology or think about it academically. This is about how we think about technology and how it serves our art. So how an artist can use that technology to make their art better or to think about other things that are going on. And for these series of for this talk today specifically, I wanted to talk about digital humans because I have done when I first started at Chaos Group and I was able to do my Chaos Group lab stuff. I started a project that's called the WikiHuman Project. How many of you guys are familiar with the WikiHuman Project? A few of you. Okay. So the idea behind that came from me being at Digital Domain and having worked on a few digital human projects and seeing a few other digital human projects that were being worked on and getting really, really frustrated because I realized that when people were working on digital human projects, they were constantly struggling with the uncanny valley. This is the biggest thing, right? They want to conquer this thing. They want to slay it like a cockroach in a corner, right? They just like, no, it's got to go, right? And it's really it's something they were really struggling with. And what they did when they is they would get actual data of a digital human, usually from Paul, almost always from Paul. And they would take that data and they would start to manipulate that data artistically rather than treating it scientifically. And there's an important information here. When I decided to take on the digital human data that I got from Paul, the first time I actually got to see it and work on it from like the beginning, where I actually got to witness the entire process of it happening, was on Oblivion, right? And I was at Paul's lab, and we were scanning Tom Cruise, because how many of you guys have seen Oblivion? Okay. Sorry, I'm going to spoil something for those of you who haven't seen it. Anyway, Tom Cruise ends up fighting himself. And so therefore, in several shots, we need to have a Tom Cruise head replacement from some other actor. And I decided to do something very specific when I did that, is to just take the data I got straight from ICT, which is what Paul had worked on, and use it without doing anything to it. Literally just plug in the maps into the different slots of the shader and use it as it was. And then I used the very good lighting that came from the integration team at Digital Domain, and I just lit Tom exactly like that. And he looked better than anything because there is something very scientific about the way that Paul gathers data, which means that diffuse map is calibrated to a specific color space. That map works exactly the way it's supposed to. You're not supposed to mess with it, it's there. And what I learned is there's something in art that we need to be conscious of, and it's called constants. There's variables and there's constants. And if I have the constants, if I know that to be a ground truth, then I shouldn't be messing with constants because that's going to be hard. And another word for variables is choices. You make choices when you make digital humans. Using scientific data does not necessarily mean that you are going to actually remove the art of the digital human. You are just going to use stuff that makes sense, logistically speaking. Now, sometimes that constant could come from Paul directly, or it could come from you've done enough digital humans that you know what's real and what's not real and what's going to work for you, right? So work that Frank does, for example, he knows exactly where to start with a digital human. He has enough experience in that he knows that that's a constant, right? And same thing with Ian and with Scott as well, and with Hal as well. So this is something that's very important, and representing digital humans is something that's extremely hard. So, sorry, I went on my little rant before I went on this. Are you guys following along? Is everything okay? Okay, good. Okay. So let me introduce the people that are here. And someone came up to me yesterday and said that I introduced someone and said no further. You know, like, no, everyone knows who this person is. And he says, actually, I didn't know who that was, and I had to look him up. So I'm going to actually go into a few more details. All right. So Ian Spriggs here. Ian Spriggs is an amazing artist who I discovered on the internet, as a lot of people have, through ArtStation. And what inspired me the most when I saw Ian's work was, besides his incredible talent to represent photorealistic humans, was the choices that he made to look at art history and realize that art history has a lot to teach you about digital humans. Because it's not about digital humans, it's about the fact that Rembrandt was dealing with the uncanny valley just as much as we are today, right? And if you look at the Mona Lisa, you can say she's kind of in the uncanny valley. That's, I think, why people look at her a lot. It's like, what's wrong with her? She's got a weird smile, right? So art history is an important part to play here. So please, thank you, Ian, for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
And then Paul needs no further introduction. No, Paul is, I have been friends with Paul for a very long time, and when I first, you know, saw Paul's work, it changed my life because he introduced image-based lighting to the world of CG in a lot of ways, right? I call him the... I call him the Michael Jordan of CG lighting. So, but Paul also does has taken a lot of the knowledge he does as you would do as an artist or as a scientist or as an academic or just someone who loves to work in CG, and taken every level to that to something new, right? And that involved the work that he's done at ICT, which, and Paul works for Google now, by the way, so he's still at ICT and at Google. But Paul developed something called a light stage. And that light stage technology, which is incredible because it actually can capture people's faces to such an extreme level. Which is what we're using on the WikiHuman data. We're using 16K displacement maps on skin, right? We're going down to sub-pore level. What's the resolution, Paul?
About a hundredth of a millimeter.
1/100th of a millimeter is how high a resolution we're getting down to the skin, right? And that's important for several reasons, and we'll get down to that point. But thank you so much, Paul, for being here. Hal Hickel is an animation supervisor at ILM. How long have you been there, Hal?
22 years.
22 years. and has been thinking about animation and thinking about what that means for a long time. And I actually had the pleasure of having him on a one-on-one podcast with me earlier. And it was really cool to hear his incredible history through this area. And he and I have been talking about digital humans throughout this trip in very interesting ways. and he actually has one of the best positions about the ethics of digital humans that I've heard. You've actually had a really good position about it. I really appreciate that. So thank you, Hal, for being here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Scott Eaton, and you and I met last year, I believe, and Scott has a very important role to play in this area because he actually studies not just the faces, which is a struggle that we deal with, but the anatomy of humans, and has studied the human anatomy in a very interesting way. He also does a lot with technology to study how the digital, how the anatomy works and how humans work through technology. And he's actually going to be on two of my panels because tomorrow we're doing another panel on AI. And we can talk a little bit about today, but he has done some incredible work where AI can start to draw humans for you in a very interesting, that's just the coolest thing I've ever seen, I gotta say.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Frank, when was your last THU that you were together? Was it 3 years ago or 2 years ago?
It was 3 years ago.
Three years ago. And Frank is from Naughty Dog. He is lead character animator there. Go Naughty Dog. All I can say is that you should look up Frank's work on ArtStation because it's really hard to express how amazing his work is. Not only does he do some incredible digital human portraits on a personal level, but his work is renowned in the game industry for being some of the best representations of digital humans in games. I love playing Uncharted 4. Because, you know, for two reasons, because their characters are awesome and also because Josh is a great writer. And I love Josh's writing. But his representations of understanding digital humans on that level in the game industry, I think, is fantastic. So thank you so much, Frank, for being here.
Thank you.
All right, so I want to. How am I going to start this? Ian, your first THU was last year, right?
Yeah.
That was actually the first time you ever spoke publicly.
Yeah, I think before that I was in college in front of like 20 people.
Right.
And I was So I was quite nervous about it.
You're quite nervous about it. But you had an amazing presentation. And what you also did at that time is you started to reference things about art history. So let's start with history. Let's start with the struggle of history. What are some of the things that people had to deal with in painting that were challenges to them to represent human that you can think of?
I think one of the things was to get a true representation of what, like the realism aspect, because art started off with like a lot of religion, so they painted like Mary and Jesus, and then they started painting the lords and nobles because only they could afford it.
So there was like commissioned portraiture.
Yeah, exactly. And then after that, it kind of moved to like the lower class, and that's when I feel like the true realism started happening, where they painted like, it wasn't always about status and wealth, it started showing people for who they really are. So I think that's where the real human emotion connection kind of came into the picture. So for me, that's one of my favorite periods of art as well.
So the realism part. So what was it that was such a challenge, and how did they manage to try to represent people at that time? What were the challenges that you think that were going on in history?
I think, a good example is that Vermeer did a Girl with a Pearl Earring, where yes. They added like a backstory to this portrait, which kind of made it more believable because it's not just a face; it's actually a story of a real life. This painting, it's a painting of a maid, but she's wearing an really expensive pearl earring, and she obviously can't afford it. So you start questioning, it's like, well, maybe the artist put it on her, and then why is he putting on her? And then you start questioning, like, is he having an affair with her? Like, is this, like, love triangle? And then just because of this one simple artifact they added, it just created a whole story, and it makes you want to read more into it, and it makes it human.
So you think the story can tell a lot?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's one of the challenges they really drove into, to really try and figure out how to make people.
But also, she in that specific painting, she had a very subtle expression, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was almost like a seductive pose, actually.
Right, but seduction is subtle, right? Seduction isn't like, exactly, I want to have sex with you. Yeah, right? Yeah. It's like, no, like, hey. You know, it's subtle, right? So that's something that's interesting, is the subtlety of an expression is very hard to do, mm-hmm, to achieve that, right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting as well.
Rembrandt actually did a great job too, because Rembrandt's painted like hundreds of self, I'm not sure about hundreds, but he's painted a lot of self-portraits, and he's painted in different emotional states. So it's like it was not just like his face, like a blank face, he actually painted his emotions. So if you look back at his work, it's almost like an autobiography of his emotional lifestyle, whereas he's one of the first painters to actually really try to express some of this stuff.
Right, right, absolutely. That's great. Now, the other thing that you and I, one of the reasons I got in touch with you is because of the WikiHuman project, right?
Yeah.
And I saw his work, and I said, I actually, in the WikiHuman project, I have several different groups of people that are involved, and the WikiHuman project is actually this idea that we are creating a digital human data set that we are actually giving out. We're going to give out. It's a bit of a struggle right now, but we have this data set. We're going to give it out to the community to use for free, right? And that data set, a lot of that data set comes from Paul's work, right? And Paul and the ICT agreed that we would basically scan someone to the highest level possible fidelity we can get so that everyone could see what really good data looked like, right? And besides that, we also had people like Ian, et cetera, because I think there needs to be an opinion from the artistic point of view of people who know how to understand what the human is, to give us feedback as opposed to just looking at it scientifically. But the science is the important part as well, because the way that we're looking at this data set, it's the ground truth in a lot of ways. It's not necessarily the only truth, it's just the best data we have, and we're making it as neutral as possible. And that data set is really interesting. But Paul, why don't you talk people through the process of what it takes to actually scan a human? So we did Mike Seymour for our data set, and he's gonna be coming out soon, I promise. But tell us a little bit about the process of scanning Mike.
Absolutely. So Mike Seymour, who writes for fxguide.com, which has great articles about all sorts of things that we care about, he was scanned with our polarized gradient illumination facial scanning process. And that's actually kind of the more recent development of what we do with light stages. It was interesting being involved in like computer graphics research back in the late 1990s, because at that point no one had really ever rendered a photoreal digital human before. That was this holy grail, and since it had never been done, it wasn't clear it was possible yet. And it was amazing that these things had been achieved artistically for hundreds of years in art, but we just didn't understand scientifically how to actually get something that you would read as a human, and getting to switch over and see Curious Case of Benjamin Button managed to do it was a huge change. The first attempts that we had to try to capture it photographically was to light the person from one light source at a time and just get this database of 500 images from every lighting direction, get that from multiple viewpoints, get that multiple expressions, and now you have every lighting condition, every viewpoint, every expression. You have everything you need in order to just look up from data what the face should look like as it animates in the scene. And that actually kind of was what got used in Spider-Man 2 and Superman Returns in the early light stage processes. But it was just way too much data to effectively use that for all the expressions. And what we did for Mike Seymour is this new version of the process. We take about 20 photos from about 8 cameras, and they're surrounded by the sphere of light, and we switch the polarization of the light, so the specular reflection, the shine of the skin, either disappears or comes back. So the difference between those two images is just the specular map. The cross-polarized is just the diffuse map, and it's pretty good texture map because it's very flat lit. Graham Fife in our group actually has a technique that'll even factor out kind of mathematically the ambient occlusion. So you even take out the ambient occlusion from the maps as well. And then we vary the directionality of the light to kind of blurry light from the front, the right, the top, the bottom. And from that we can figure out, based on how light plays off of the skin, the surface orientation map for every skin pore. And that starts as 0.1 millimeter accurate detail for the normal map or displacement map. And then if we do super high res on a certain skin patches, which I think we did for Mike,
Yeah, we did.
Then we can get microgeometry, and through texture synthesis, we can go up to 16K maps. So if you put that into a nice renderer such as V-Ray and set the subsurface scattering parameters well, it'll produce a pretty realistic face from that data.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what's amazing to me about that data set was the fact that because the data was such high resolution and so accurate, I actually got to stop using certain things. For example, I didn't feel I needed to actually use a specular map anymore, because a specular map is just a specular occlusion, right? And if I have so much high resolution data, I just might as well make it 100% reflective and use Fresnel to make sure I get everything right, right?
Yeah, and so, a specular roughness map also at some point, you don't need that anymore because all of the changes in roughness of the skin, it's not...
comes from geometry.
In the BRDF, it doesn't have to be in the BRDF because it's actually in the geometry at some point.
Yeah, and that became a thing. It's like, I want to reduce as many variables as possible when it comes to representing humans, and it's been really kind of an interesting journey to do that. But the thing is, when you start to really represent humans and you start to do things with humans and you start putting them into films, it becomes a bit of a challenge now that you can actually do it, right? I mean, you were mentioning the fact that we didn't know if you can actually do it. Now we can actually do it. And how you and I were talking about yesterday about that challenge, right? Because you were dealing with an ethical challenge that was going on when you were working on Force Awakens. No, sorry, Rogue One.
Rogue One.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the big question that comes up a lot centers around cases where you are recreating an actor who's no longer alive, and the question of, you know, is that ethical, because that actor can't be asked if they would do that role or not. And there's a very, you know, one school of thought is there's a sort of an absolute answer to that, which is, well, if you can't ask them, and you can't, then you have no business doing it. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that there's a more nuanced version of that. For instance, and this is just my personal opinion on the matter, I'm not comfortable with doing TV commercials with dead actors. I just don't think that's right. You can't ask them if they would happily sell a car, a vacuum cleaner, a candy bar. But in the case of something like Tarkin, we know from interviews with Peter Cushing that he enjoyed being in Star Wars and would have happily made more of them if his character hadn't died in the first film. We weren't asking his character to do anything that it didn't do in the first film. He stands around on the Death Star talking about blowing up planets. And Lucasfilm did talk to his estate, although that is not the equal of obviously talking to the actual person, but it's a piece of the pie. So for those reasons, we felt pretty comfortable. But the other aspect of it is, we weren't making Peter Cushing. In other words, we weren't making like a biopic about Peter Cushing and fictionalizing his life and putting words into his mouth that were supposed to represent him as a person. We were creating Tarkin. Tarkin's a different, Peter Cushing didn't go around in life dressed like Tarkin with his hair styled like that saying things about the Death Star. And I think that's important. For instance, if you're making a Frankenstein film and you want the Karloff Frankenstein, I think that if you are asking that character to do things that were that are consistent with what we understand about the Frankenstein's monster, then I think that's probably appropriate. On the other hand, if you're making some crazy new modern Frankenstein, and Frankenstein's gonna like have sex and do things that we've never seen before, maybe you should design a new monster. Leave Karloff out of it. That's my opinion. But the whole thing gets, it gets into a lot of sticky areas. But I think, but that's kind of where I've settled with with regard to that particular aspect of the ethical question of sort of resurrecting actors. But like I said, if someone, well, so here's the other part of it is, and this is curious to me, this question only seems to come up, as far as I've noticed, with cases of CG characters. But all the time we have, you know, Gary Oldman playing Winston Churchill in makeup. We've got Anthony Hopkins playing Alfred Hitchcock, you know, in makeup. And in those cases, that they're not playing characters that Hitchcock or Winston Churchill played. They're playing the actual person and fictionalizing their lives. You would think that would be much more controversial, but really the only complaints you generally hear about movies like that are whether or not they were historically accurate or whatever. But I don't really recall people saying, oh, it's totally unethical for Gary Oldman to be Winston Churchill or for Anthony Hopkins to be Hitchcock. I mean, maybe somebody complained about it, but I've never seen an article that said that. On the other hand, you do something like Tarkin, and there wasn't like a flood of criticism or anything, but I do get asked about it a lot, and I have seen people comment on it online about, well, you know, is that ethical? And the thing is that hiring Guy Henry as an actor and transforming him into Tarkin via CG is not one iota different than hiring Gary Oldman to play Winston Churchill and transforming him with makeup. There is zero difference. And yet, for some reason, there's a difference between those two things. So I find that curious as well. And again, I would think that in the cases of biopics where you're actually recreating the actual person and their real life, I would think the onus of authenticity and the question of whether that's ethical or not would be much more pointed, and yet nobody bats an eyelid, but we bring back Tarkin and I get this, you know, we get this question a lot. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really interesting. And I've been thinking about it a lot. It's like, you're 100% right. You have a question? Okay, all right, hold on.
Audience involvement.
I think the point is about discernibility, right? If you have Winston Churchill, like Gary Oldman playing Winston Churchill in makeup, you can clearly still tell that that isn't Winston Churchill. But if you have like a CG, realistic CG rendering of some person being played by somebody else, you can't really tell the difference if it's really good.
I guess, although I think the intention behind the makeup in the Churchill film was to make Gary look, I mean, if they could have made him look absolutely 100% like Winston Churchill, they would have done that. I mean, you know what I mean? They got as close as they could. So I guess what I'm saying is, I don't think there was any intention there to sort of pull back in order to be sensitive to the fact that you know, to the thing. I think that if the makeup artist could have made him look 100% perfectly like Churchill, they would have done that. And so then I think, again, it's kind of the same thing, in my opinion anyways.
So just thinking about this, is there a point when a likeness of a person falls out of copyright, right? So Churchill died, whatever.
Do you own a copyright to your face, Scott?
But in 70 years, it might not be an issue, or whatever our current copyright law stretches to.
Well, actually,
but,
a lot of actors now are having their contracts drawn up to make sure that
Last will and testimony has it so that his estate cannot give the right of his likeness to anyone.
Right.
Yep. Which is,
but okay, so everything is copyright protected. Every creation is copyright protected for 70 years or 100 years, or I don't know what it extends to with extensions, but if you recreate William Shakespeare perfectly, if he was contemporaneous, and would people care? Because he's dead 100. If we recreated him perfectly,
well,
nobody would care.
Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln, nobody cares that he's, you know.
Exactly, because he's out of copyright.
Yeah.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Like, so the issue is somebody who's recently deceased, and
Is a Rembrandt copyrighted?
What's that?
Is a Rembrandt copyrighted?
No, absolutely not.
So if I copied a Rembrandt,
yeah,
that's cool.
It actually is cool under copyright laws. Like, no, you can copy away.
Yeah, but I take your meaning. I mean, the more recent the person's deceased, then
it's more sensitive.
There's going to be more sensitivity, and but then of course, if you go very recent, you have you know, the with everyone's blessing, of course, and even the participation of the family, you have what is very respectful recreation of Paul Walker for Fear of Seven.
Yes.
And that's as recent as you can get. Yep. And of course, there was a very good reason to do that, because they were in the middle of a film that Walker obviously wished to complete, would have completed, and his family participated, and you talked about it in your talk. But I mean, that's sort of the ultimate version of like very recent. But on the other hand, if you had something that was that recent, and I can't think of a made-up example, but something that recent where someone sort of exploitatively made a movie about that person, that would be pretty questionable, I think.
And this, the natural extension of this entire conversation is to recreating people who are still alive.
But hold on, I'm going to get to you two as well, because I do have points to get there. But just since we're on this subject, and you're bringing up about, you know, that, Paul also got involved in the Holocaust preservation, right? You were preserving history by talking about Holocaust victims or survivors and preserving their likeness in a holographic form, right?
Yeah.
So don't you think there's value to that?
In the case of documenting with the University of Southern California's Shoah Foundation, we documented 12 survivors of the Holocaust. You know, they're typically in their 80s these days. And we got about 1,000 question and answer responses from each one of them. And when we put the display of them, we could play back any one of the responses. And we were very careful that we'd only play back responses that they gave verbatim. And we even had debates about when it, when they're done, they basically have to go back to kind of like the listening loop of what they look like when they're waiting for the next question. And there was some thought, like, maybe we'll try to do some intelligent morph from when they ended the question to just going back to the listening pose. And sometimes that just didn't look right when we did it. But also, I got concerned about even that. And so instead, we did an obvious cross-dissolve so that it's not seamless, people understand what's going on, and it stays, true to everything that was said in a way that people understand it. Yeah. That seemed to be important.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I do want to start to talk, Scott, a little bit about the challenges of digital humans, and we've obviously been talking a lot of stuff we've been dealing with is mainly about faces, right? Obviously, Ian and Frank, they represent the entire human, but what a lot of people seem to focus on when they see those types of images and portraits is about their face, right? The face is a regression. But I want to talk about the rest of the anatomy, because this is something you know a lot about. What are some of the challenges that a lot of people think about the uncanny valley, et cetera. What are some of the challenges in the anatomy of a body that make it that you see that are involved in digital humans?
So the biggest challenge, the uncanny valley is the uncanny valley because of our perception. The way that we're wired to read expressions, to be social animals, and somehow survive or whatever evolutionarily happened to make us really want to attend to each other's faces, right? So super important to us. Body's less important, but the second most important information channel that we have is our hands, right? Gesticulation. So there's a lot of nonverbal communication that comes from this, and I'm doing it right. I'm doing
Vikram.
It right now.
I spoke to Vikram earlier. You know, he's
right, and there's some Italians out there, like Andrea. Are you out there? He's like knocking glasses of wine over at dinner just because he can't control himself. It happened like two or three times yesterday. I noted it. But similar challenges. I mean, I think in faces, the obvious challenge that hasn't across the uncanny valley is animation. It is, because there is a fidelity to the deformations in the face that we haven't captured yet. And we can get kind of the gross, and when I say gross, I mean it's maybe we can record the endpoints of the shapes at each kind of expression, and we get some interpolation. But for me, kind of having looked at things quite closely for a long time, it's to do with orbicularis oris, right? The mouth muscle right? And it's actually a big spiral of fibers that can contract independently, and we get some very continuous shapes out of our mouth when we do almost any vocalization. And right now is very crude, not very crude, it was very crude 10 years ago, but now it's, you know, talking in kind of nerd language, you know, if what you could do with your mouth was like a continuous curve, right now we sample it at like 4 points and you get this thing that's like not smooth, right? And you can get better, but then to get like perfect, you need to have, or it perceivably perfect to us. It doesn't need to be continuous. It just needs to be high enough fidelity that it captures the things that we're wired to see. And I don't know how you guys do it at ILM with animation and lip sync, but I suppose somebody's thought of getting like a deaf person into to lip read, if you can lip read the character clearly as well as they could do a human. I think that's a metric for passing. And I don't know if that happens, but it, for me, that's the failure point. Right now, I think everything else is looks pretty good. As far as the bodies go, it's we can sample data, and that's the most reliable way to do it. If your goal is realism, you want to sample the thing. You want to scan it like we do now. We scan things. We don't want to sculpt them by hand. I talk a lot about that, but we can talk more about it later. But obviously, when you move, it's the same thing. The deformation of the mouth that I'm talking about, the deformation of the body, is it integrates the depth of muscles from the bones outward to produce a movement on the surface. That is really hard. It's really hard from a technical perspective, like just the computation. But probably even more prohibitive is that it's impossible to author. Right, it's impossible for any one of us who knows anything about anatomy to sit there and model all the little muscle tubes and fibers, you know, like we're talking about forearms, deep extensors and pronators and supinators. They're in there somewhere and they're influencing the surface when you do this. And so the challenge is doing that to high enough fidelity that it makes it perfect, right? Yeah. And we won't, visibly perfect. And I think there's nobody here from WETA, is there? I don't think there's any WETA representatives here, but I think, and I only have passing knowledge of this, but some of the work they did on Planet of the Apes 2, I think went a few steps to address this, in that they were doing like their best muscle simulation, which is probably the best in the industry. But again, how do you author it? How do you get all those little muscles hooked up correctly? Doing it by hand, no thanks. I would even turn that job down, right? Because it's hard work and shitty work, right? But they scanned a chimpanzee in an MRI scanner, so you can get, you know, MRI scanner. It kind of, you know, images the inside of your body and the different tissues, and then they extracted all the muscles that way. So they created the volumes, correct volumes, the correct layers, and then you can hook it up with, you know, scripts or something, right? As opposed to an artist having to understand enough to author it, which, impossible, right?
Yeah.
And so those are the steps. And in a lot of ways, you know, it's the same thing with facial animation. The end point is sampling and doing, like, simulation.
But when you're dealing with film and you're talking about things like Weta's doing all this crazy, you know, MRI scan, et cetera, and they're trying to get incredible micro detail, even like, you know, what we were doing with Paul, where we're getting incredible 16K displacement map. That's not always possible when it comes to specifically in the world of games, which is now actually really challenging the way that we're seeing humans. Digital humans are actually becoming much more common in games, right? Because we've got a lot of talent in that area that are making it happen. And you don't necessarily have the choice, you know, you were talking about the mouth face, right? It's like you're dealing with, you're saying right now we're at 8-bit and you want to go to 32-bit mouth,
effectively,
right?
Effectively.
So, but that doesn't happen. And yet, you know, when I play a game like Uncharted 4, when I play stuff that I've seen from Frank's work, I'm like, that's pretty freaking good. You know, and it's in real time. I'm seeing it happen in real time. Frank, what are some of the challenges or some of the things that you've had to deal with, you know, when you're dealing with a character? Because you're not just dealing with a character for a specific performance. You're dealing with a character from any angle, from anything. So how do you do that?
So I think I totally agreed what Scott said about animation. It's right now in the industry, I think, game particular, it's very challenging to make a realistic human being. A lot of times when we see people modeling, scanning, and then when it's still, just, you know, in a certain lighting condition, it looks flawless, it looks great. But all the things starting just falling apart when it's starting to talk, open the mouth, all this kind of stuff, just, to me, it's because we have a lot of restrictions just in game. For example, when we scan all the shapes in game, let's say, okay, so last time when we say in game, real time, probably the most realistic that I've ever seen, it's a demo that Unreal released. Yeah, have you guys seen that one? Yeah, right? That's Andy Serkis, that's one of it. And I had a chance to go in and see like very closely how did they do it. Well, impossible, right now, how they're doing is impossible to make it in-game, but it's real-time. They model every single hair in geometry, or some of the cards, mixing with geometry, and then all the facial animation was scanned based on those conversations that he's talking. In-game, we cannot do this kind of stuff. It will take forever to make a game. So how we do it is basically when we scan it, we scan shapes, right? We basically break down all the shapes of what we can do. For example, we have like a corner puller, basically pulling the side of your mouth as far as possible, and when we're doing it, we do it more exaggerated, so we can, when animators are doing it, we can do it in the middle, 30%, 40%, so far and so forth. And that goes to every single muscle that we can think of that we can scan. And it is very hard to put all that blend shape into game engine, right? Sure. We're talking about the game engine that we're talking about, and the restriction is basically right now, if you want to support a fully blend shape in game engine, it's still very hard. So what we're doing in Naughty Dog specifically, we're talking about having all this blend shape information and then bake into joints. So it's really just depending on how many joints can we afford on the human face. Right now, I don't want to just say a number, but I think we are around like 500 something joint just on the face.
500 joints on the face.
500 something, like it could be 600, but around that area, okay. Just on the face to make everything, all the information baked into the joint. But still, when you have a blend shape that has animation baked into joint, because some part of it, especially around the mouth and the eyes, you know, if you don't have enough joints, things will break. And when things break, that's when people will just kind of say, what is going on?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So there's a lot of that kind of moment. It's sure. Very challenging. And for us, it's definitely not just modeling side. It's modeling, rigging, animator, and, you know, just basically the whole studio, because when we are having review, we have this kind of, probably the size of a theater, and a big screen, and then all the leads will get it together, and we'll review the animation that we have, and people speak up when they see something wrong about it. Yeah. It's basically a lot of, you know, back and forth to make sure that when the actor or character that we're doing, when they're speaking, when they're doing stuff, it looks realistic. Yeah, so it's not an easy process, and I don't think there's an easy process to do this in game industry right now. It's a lot of work back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that representing humans, you know, either, you know, from the painting point of view or all the way down to making video games, right? It's always going to be a challenge. It's not going to be like there's no make it easy button. Although we'll get to that tomorrow with Scott. But
you have the make it easy button?
I do.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah, he has a make it easy button, but he doesn't actually. It's pretty well. It's really cool. But I want to open up the door
really
to questions.
Make,
so guys,
makes everybody else's life
yeah. Oh,
big,
Vikram has a question. Okay, go ahead.
I couldn't help but relate as you guys were speaking about something else completely. We are entertainers. We do beautiful things for consumption, for entertainment primarily. And a lot of you are researchers, just for the beauty of it, like Scott, he's an educator, and he just loves to, you know, like get into the depth of things as he expounded just now. I couldn't help but get back to a memory of mine and think about the subject of losing a person in my life, the subject of bereavement, and say, what could I do to treasure moments of that person? It opened up a complete line of thought as I was thinking about it. Memories that I'd love to preserve about a person, right? I'm just opening a can of worms. It's not a particular question, but yes, but I could think about things like little gestures, little moments. Like we record videos today. We have pictures of people that we like. What if I could have sound bites to go with gestures that I liked about people close to me? And I could always go back to that. Does it open up a whole
For
new
sure.
use of this?
It seems reasonable that, you know, we used to have photographs, then we had video of our loved ones. It seems reasonable that someday we'll have something like what Paul did with these Holocaust, you know, survivors.
That's exactly what.
But for our family, and we'll be able to sit down and have a conversation with Grandma, you know, long after she's gone. Yeah.
Didn't they do that on Superman?
What's that?
Didn't they do that on Superman?
Oh, yeah. There you go.
A little bit.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. You worked on iRobot, is that right?
I did.
The digital domain. So at the beginning, Will Smith talks to a hologram of some scientist who is deceased.
Yeah.
And it's kind of one of these conversations. It was the guy who was the farmer in the Babe movies. He's a scientist in this film. And he's asking questions. And then whenever Will Smith asks a question that he doesn't have the answer to because he didn't pre-record it, apparently, he says, I'm sorry, I can't help you. You must ask the right questions. The vision where you could like take everything anybody's ever said, and if it's a public figure, there'll be tons of stuff on YouTube, and you throw it all into a big hopper of deep learning algorithms and such, and then you train something that can reply. I think that might come up with something that kind of eerily gets it right, or seems like it gets it right some of the time. I don't know if it'll go all the way because, you know, I think like the, just speaking philosophically, you know, the particular person, you know, they're an ephemeral thing. Every single real interaction we have during our life, it's like there's no way to do it again. And even if you could simulate something that's like it, it still wouldn't have been an actual event from that person's life, and it would be impossible to ring true. So it might be a window into experiencing what they did in life, but I'm not sure if we'll cross the valley to feeling like they're really still with us.
Yeah, well, what's the... Who's the guy that built the robot that's like his...
Is David Hansen's robot? Or
is that the one? And it's I forget the story of it, but that's kind of like that, right? It's supposed to... She's supposed to... Is it someone that died, or is it...
Well, I'll just check a quick story. There's a kind of a distant uncle of mine. I've actually done a podcast with him. His name is Rudy Rucker. Anyone know who Rudy Rucker is? Anyone? Yeah, you guys should know who Rudy Rucker is. He's also known as the godfather of cyberpunk, right? So he kind of started the cyberpunk movement. And back in the late 70s, he wrote a book called Software. And the software was a story about someone that you could download your entire brain and put it onto some storage, right? And you could, you know, preserve your entire state of brain in this area. And what he, and I met him recently, and he said he's doing something called his life box, right? Huh. And what his life box is basically a deep learning algorithm that is studying. He's written a lot of books, I think like 50 books or something like that. And he's also written several academic books and all this other stuff. And he's basically training a deep learning system to basically learn everything that he's ever written or said. And basically, I said, why are you doing that? He goes, because I'm scared of dying. Why the hell do you think I'm doing that? You know? So there is something about trying to figure out about preserving yourself in some way or shape or form. But we have another question here. Hold on a second.
Yes, so my question maybe leads a little bit toward tomorrow's talk, but I'm curious to know, and especially for you, Paul, if right now in the last months, we've seen development using deep learning algorithms, let's say like the deepfake algorithms stuff to recreate digital humans using deep learning algorithms. And those algorithms basically just use like data set from Google or from other search engine to like recreate those like really convincing fake humans or adaptation or facial replacement. And I was wondering if, Paul, you had did some research using your Lightfield or your Lightwig system about how to create a perfect data set to fill in a deep learning algorithm so that you can recreate, using deep learning, a really credible digital human.
Excellent thought. And I think that these algorithms, like when I saw, you know, early results using these deep learning facial synthesis things. I mean, the thing that just kind of blows you away is that it actually, like, it matches the lighting. It works for a variety of angles. It gets all the dimensions.
Yeah, but doesn't it do that because it morphs it instead of actually shading it, right?
I mean, it's a massive interpolation from the data, and it's not shading. It's not thinking about subsurface scattering or specular reflections or anything.
Right, right, right.
And it's doing pretty well. And one would expect that with more data, more computation, and tuning the algorithms, this stuff will get at least 10 times as good. And that's going to be good for a lot of applications. It's almost certainly going to be good enough to generate, you know, fake news videos, which we're going to have to deal with. And hopefully people will understand, you know, what the implications of that are. I think that if we want to do really high quality stuff, then that might be a great use of light stage data as just really good ground truth for deep learning algorithms. And that might be the last use of light stage data at that point, because then all you need is a cell phone photo of somebody and you can hallucinate the rest.
Yeah, we're already fitting that technology into our pipeline. And in the short term, it'll be for things like, you know, simple shots that come up all the time on films where they had to use a stunt person for the actor, and we normally do kind of a face swap to make it look like the actor. And deepfakes is gonna make that kind of work way easier, way faster, much simpler. But I think that it's the kind of thing that will provide solutions for questions we don't have yet. But in the short term, it's going to make stuff like face swaps and digital stunt doubles and things like that like way easier, much faster to produce. Absolutely.
Do we have any other questions? I have another subject, but any other questions before we move on?
Before you move on, yeah, I just wanted to circle back. I totally 1,000% agree with what you were saying about, for instance, especially about facial movement. Mm. It's obviously as an animation soup, you know, the motion aspect of it is something I'm a lot more keyed into than necessarily the intricacies of subsurface scattering and those things. I mean, I pay attention to those things, but you know what I'm saying, the movement. And when currently, at least at ILM, if we're capturing an actor, you know, using at least the current paradigm of dots and the little helmet with cameras, our current system gets pretty darn good data, like a lot of detail, a lot of really fine detail, micro movements, all that stuff. And if we slap it on another human, like a CG human, we get a very realistic result. But my problem with it is that historically, whether it's facial capture, whether it's keyframed, whatever it is, historically it's always been an outside-in approach. It's a shell that you're affecting. How you're either driving it with motion capture data or you're driving it with blend shapes or whatever you're doing, and it's not from the outside in. It's not the muscles, it's not all that stuff you talked about driving it. And if you didn't need to edit it at all, and you could just take the pure motion capture data and put it on the other actor, great. You'd actually be fine the way the technology is now, depending on whose pipeline we're talking about and the fidelity of the capture they're getting. But the problem is you frequently, almost always, have to edit it. And as soon as you start moving it, you start breaking things. Because you're not moving it, you're not driving those movements by the from the inside out, from the facial muscles, driving, you know, pushing the fascia and then pushing the skin and doing the right things. And so you get into trouble, and you get into very weird, hard to define trouble. Like, it's not always super obvious. It's like some transitory thing between two phonemes where the phonemes look fine, but there's some weird thing happening in between that it's like, what? That? Oh, that feels weird. Why does it feel weird? It's hard to tease out. So one of the things we're pushing on now at ILM is a proper muscle system for the face, so that even if you're using facial capture to begin with, which is a shell, that can be sort of, you know, driven down onto this muscle system.
Right.
And then if you make changes, like you want the character to smile a little bigger on that smile or whatever the changes are, you're doing it via that muscle system, which means you're never, if it's a good muscle system, you're never going to break it. You're not going to do anything illegal. You're not going to do anything the face can't do. And so those transitions should feel natural. The changes you make should feel natural, but you can still also preserve the great stuff you got from the initial capture. Anyways, for me, that's like the next step to make things better than they are now.
Right, right. Because
so when you said that, I was like, oh, yes.
And how?
No.
Go ahead.
How do you guys approach that muscle system?
Well, I'm not working on it personally.
Oh, okay.
I'm also arguably the least technical animation supervisor at ILM. I think we've got some people there who are, you know, kind of Renaissance people who are like super technical in their animation soups. But I've seen tests of it, actually on the Hulk, just some test shots where they were showing, you know, what it could do, and I'm excited about it. But what the actual, you know, how exactly the muscles have been modeled and what's driving them and all that, if you ever talk to Brian Cantwell or somebody, he could probably give you an actual proper explanation of it.
It's also, I mean, it's kind of, and I'm playing the devil's advocate a little bit because I haven't seen the tech, but you know, it's the conservation of volume, right?
Which is one of the things that almost fails when we're talking about the muscle.
It's not just the muscles.
I mean,
everything.
When the lips compress, that they don't get thin and weird, or they
squish out collagen.
That's exactly right. Have you guys seen BBX? You've seen BBX, yeah. Have you seen BBX?
What is that? Tell me.
Mark Sager's AI baby.
Is that the iPhone-driven thing? No, that's a baby thing.
Okay, if you haven't seen, look up Baby X by Mark Sager. That's a muscle-driven system. It has to be, because that's the only way it's going to work. It basically acts and reacts to the way you work, right? It doesn't have a bunch of blend shapes of a baby. Yeah. It's basically just a muscle system that's driving it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I was looking at this, and I was actually asking the digital human group, and I was asking people like Steve Prieg and stuff, and he goes, it's going to work up to a point right now, right? That's the way it was felt, that blend shapes are still stuck with blend shapes for a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not going to get micro motion out of muscle systems. I don't think we're going to get micro motion.
You can combine both. That's my hope, is that particularly with, you know, I feel like more and more of at least the work we're doing at ILM involves to some degree facial capture, right? And at least the system we've got going now, and then there's always room for improvement, and we're trying to improve, but we're getting like super fine, like really fine little micro details. The problem is, it's a shell, and when you need to edit it, you can break it very easily.
Right.
But if you can push that down into the muscle system, edit it on the muscle system, and then bring it back out again, you can actually have a bit of both. You can use the deltas that had all that super fine little stuff,
okay,
but the changes will kind of override in areas, but in legal ways, because it's driven by the muscles. Anyways, that's the idea. You know,
it sounds very interesting, because I think that obviously muscles are what move our face, and if we imitate muscles, then we will actually get faces to look right, and that comes down to the same thing that, you know, Paul's been doing for all these years.
In respect to
our
Paul's,
face,
in respect to Paul's work, his data is sampling he's sampling physical data. And when you're working with muscle systems, what I was saying about the Weta thing, that's the right way to approach it, is to MRI scan, get a really high MRI scan of the face.
And you're segmenting
the muscles.
Sure.
And you're segmenting fat tissue, you're segmenting any kind of collagen. Yeah. And you know, like if I wanted to do it properly, you'd be simulating the friction between the teeth and the inside of the mouth, right? Because that has a huge component. And okay, that, you know, these are all the things that you would need to get the muscle, the lips to move properly.
Right.
In my opinion, right? Just from first principles.
Do you mind if I add something?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I think a lot of the conversation has been based about trying to get like a representational of what a digital human is, but I think a lot of what makes a human is like the subconscious emotional stuff. So I think even if you get like a complete one-to-one representation, it's not necessarily going to be human. So I think there's a lot of stuff, we got all the constants, but all those variables are still so many unknown things.
Well, so what does it take, Ian?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, as an artist, I think like, with my work especially, I try and add a little bit of style. So I don't go for the photorealism because I don't think photorealism is the best way to get a true representation of a human. So by adding style, which is kind of a little bit of the art side into it, so away from the technical, I try to surpass it in a way and try and get that human emotional connection.
But also. At least in the current paradigm for movie visual effects, and I guess the games as well, there's still an actor behind the human characters, at least, and they hopefully provide an emotional connection by the choices they make and the performance they give. You know what I mean? Like that, I think that's a part of what you're talking about in terms of connecting with an audience.
I actually think that digital humans have a bigger role to play than films, right?
Absolutely.
So digital humans are going to represent a big part of our lives at some point, shape, and form. So there's not necessarily going to be an actor there.
Exactly. That's why I say the current paradigm is that they drive
the current paradigm. Sure.
Ultimately, though, we're going to see synthespians who are driven by AI, and they're won't be an actor involved, and there may not even be a writer involved. Like it's totally an AI-driven thing, and that's going to be a very interesting thing to see. And I wonder, and it makes me feel like it's just because I'm old. I wonder, you know, I like actors, I like people, I like my actors that I know. You know, I like seeing Jack Nicholson or whoever. So then I wonder, will I ever fully connect with a synthetic person, then I know, you know, there's no actor behind it. There may not even be a human writer behind it. It's a completely AI-driven thing. Will I always just be kind of like, you know, that's nothing to me. I don't even, you know, like to borrow from Westworld, I don't see anything there or whatever the line is when they look at the photograph. So I don't know the answer to that, but I suspect that future generations are going to accept those beings in a way that I may not. So
like, you know, Ian does portraits of his friends, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right? And you do beautiful portraits of your friends. And I've never met your friends. In fact, I only know your friends through their digital representation that you've done of them.
That's true.
And that's your own interpretation of them.
Oh, good
And
point.
Yet when I...
But you connect.
Oh, yeah. I want to have a, you know...
That's a good point.
I want to have a beer with your friends.
It's almost like, I'm doing my friends because I already know how to represent them because I know them as a human. With the digital humans we use in visual effects, we're representing a character, not so much the human being, so there's almost a two-step.
Well, also, but it's part of it, too, that you know him. Yes. I mean, you know he created that image. And
I didn't know. No, I didn't. I knew him virtually until I met him last year, right?
I guess what I mean is you know some human being created that image. And does that form part of your connection to it? Like if you saw an image that was awesome, but you knew that no human had ever had any involvement with whatsoever, it was completely generative AI, would you have the same emotional connection? And I'm not saying you wouldn't. I mean, maybe I would. I'm just saying it's a question I have, like, because we're not there yet. Really.
We're not there yet. Sounds scary and terrifying, but I don't know. Tomorrow we'll answer those questions.
Or maybe it'll be cool. I don't know.
But I do have a connection, and I think you're right that you made some choices in the way that you represent your friends. So those are the variables, right? So the way you showed you know, Sean, or I actually did meet Steve Wang.
Yeah,
he was at THU last year.
Yeah, he was.
And so it was kind of cool to see him. And I was like, wow, you're the actual Steve Wang, the portrait. So that's kind of cool. Yeah, but anyway, there are choices that you've made in this.
Yeah, go ahead. I've gotten to see Frank's work before meeting him here. I've gotten to see Ian's work before meeting him here. Blown away by it before. Awesome to meet the artists. And I think a huge part of what's effective about it is that, you know, their work in some sense is very realistic, but it also transcends the realism. Like, you are painting or sculpting, you know, great skin pore detail, great specular reflections. You render it with subsurface scattering, but then you also make, you know, creative simplifications, augmentations, choices, all on top of that, in an artistic way. So everything that we relate to in terms of like the realism that a character has, it's exciting us on all of those levels, and then it can deepen it by actually taking it beyond what we would have just expected from the realism, and then you can really communicate with people at a deeper level. And I think that your work is doing that, and I hope that all of this new technology we're developing, including deep learning things, we'll have artistic controls on top of what the technology can do so that we can actually turn it into something that achieves the highest level of communication.
Well, and you know, one of the things I mentioned in passing in my talk tomorrow, so you don't have to come, you guys, I'll just say it now and then you don't have to show up. But it's a very minor thing, is, and it's this question I was just asking about, you know, will I feel connected to artificial character? I don't know, we'll find out. But you know, there are Instagram influencers with millions of followers who are not humans. They're digital. They're not even that well done. I mean, in terms of realism, from a sort of visual effects person's perspective, you know, you look at them, you're like, yeah, that's CG. But they're not stylized. They're meant to look like real people. Like Lil Michaela, I don't know if you guys have seen Lil Michaela on Instagram. She's got like a million and a half followers. And I think there are a bunch of people out there who actually care about her little storylines and stuff. And I don't mean care about it like the way you care about a cartoon character that you know is just a cartoon character, but you're still invested in it. Like, I think there are people who think of her as kind of like a real person. And so that's interesting to me. And there's a team of people behind her that create her, but I don't think any of those people that really are invested in her as a character are invested because they know humans created her. I just think they immediately bond to her. They saw her image, they saw her lifestyle, and they bought it. And I find that utterly fascinating because there's nothing there. It's pixels and nothing else. But they've bought into it as a person's lifestyle, just like they have with Kim Kardashian's lifestyle. And they don't know Kim any more than they know Lil Michaela. So in essence, they're both just as fake and unreal and distant from them, but they buy in, some subset of people buy into both of them equally, and that to me is kind of mind-blowing. And when you start to create digital characters like that through AI that aren't just pictures on Instagram, but they actually act and talk and have a personality that's 100% generated by AI, that's going to be pretty freaky.
It could be really freaky, or it could just be the fact that, you know, this entire world around you is created as a hologram and as a hallucination,
exactly.
And therefore
it doesn't really matter. This is all a simulation anyways, so I mean,
so
you know, what does
cares?
It matter?
You know, like, who cares? All of this is part of your imagination, you know?
Red pill, blue pill.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter that whoever it is. I think when you have friends, I love the fact that the art battle is going on next door. The fact that you guys have friends is filling a void in your life, right? And maybe that void can be filled in another way. And I hope, and, you know, it's maybe it's sad that it's artificial, or maybe it's just fine that it's artificial.
Yeah,
who cares?
Well, yeah,
you know?
Totally. I mean, I suspect kids, young people now, will have a completely different feeling about that than some old fart like me who's grown up on, you know, actors. God, how old fashioned is that? You know. So.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions here from the audience? Anyone? Yes, we got one more.
Uh-oh. Oh, shit.
I got Hal concerned. this is less a question, but more a comment. It seems like we're talking about communication, and does it need to be perfectly real to communicate? You know, and, you know, we're talking about Ian's work. it would make me think of, I've seen side-by-side comparisons between John Singer Sargent paintings with the photo reference, and the painting feels more like the person that I don't know than the photo does.
Well, you know, that's my dirty secret. I actually hate creating just spot-on, realistic CG humans. Like, nothing is more boring to me. My worst nightmare is to be handed a project with, like, 800 shots of, you know, some totally realistic CG human. I would shoot myself in the head. Agreed. I'd much rather work on another, you know, Davy Jones, or even just gently stylized or you know, modified sort of realistic character, but not just spot on dead, you know, dead on human. That's a nightmare.
Yeah, it's something that's intriguing to me. You know, Scott, we were talking about your work the other day over lunch, and it's beautiful. But it seems like there's this conversation that we're trying to do with entertainment, or when, Chris, you're talking about the future interactions that we might have with, whether it's an AI, I'm not going to say person, it's a character, and how they're behaving. Communication can take place at the simplest level with a sphere and a triangle and a cube, and, you know, we all saw The Incredibles. I relate to that family. I interact with that family, and I believe I've seen kids aren't, you know, Hal, you keep talking about, you know, I'm an old people too. But I don't see kids gravitating toward that in terms of communication. And it's less right. about me being kind of devil's advocate, but more about, if we're talking about communication, I think we're willing to accept a lot and, in a wide range of things. And it's why I look at those, you know, if we're talking about this 1,000-year quest and trying to study this idea of painters who got it right, those painters, I can clearly see those brushstrokes, but I still buy what they're doing and I connect with it, you know?
Yep.
So I think it's just that kind of ethereal thing where there's that connection. Animation, when it moves and it's under light, that's the toughest part of it, the problem the painters didn't have. It's, I don't know, I'm just blathering on now.
Shut up, Jan.
I had too many beers. Yeah, but, you know, that's kind of what, it's like, I love the conversation, and it just seems like everybody keeps going back to the question of how these things will communicate, how we will interact with these things,
yeah,
and how do they really need to be represented for us to have a meaningful conversation.
Thank you, Shan. That was an amazing question. But I have a comment on this, and that's the fact that I think that there is there's a connection you make with a face. And it can be done. Like Wally did it with nothing, just, you know, whatever Wally had. But there is a facial expression of empathy that I think is important when it comes down to digital humans at some point. And that's what you're gonna be able to relate to. And if you're able to replicate that emotion of empathy, then that's gonna be able to allow you to connect with that a little bit more.
But what I'm saying is, I'm already able to connect to a human character that's a stylized character in an empathetic way. Yeah. Every time I watch a movie that's stylized and it's a stylized human character, I don't need it to be perfectly down to the follicle realistic. That's where it starts to get tougher and tougher, because we know, as I'm looking at you right now, the closer it gets to you, the more my brain's going, any little thing, I'm going to notice it. So it's just more for me, it's just the idea of, I will be blown away and I will be jumping up and down if I see it. I'm excited by it. But I'm saying the question of empathy and communication, I think, already exists in things that aren't that real.
Yeah, and, you know, there's always going to be tons of stories being told with characters that don't look like real spot-on human. But there's going to be times when we need it, and, you know, all this stuff needs to be.
What he's talking about mainly is about left side of the valley. He runs to be on the left side of the valley, right? And so we've been struggling with the right side of the valley for a long time, right?
So
that is a challenge. What I actually am interested in, and one of the things that really got me when I started working on the WikiHuman project, was why the hell is there a valley in the first place, right? This is a very interesting problem. And I have a few ideas, a hypothesis about this. And my hypothesis is that the valley exists because of the way that we are when we are born, right? When we are born, and I experienced this with my daughter, and she was 5 minutes old, and the doctor handed her to me. The first thing she did after she stopped crying is she stared at my face. And that's what babies do. Babies stare at faces, right? And they stare at faces because they want to learn this. And the first thing that we learn as babies is to study a face. And if you go to a restaurant, you'll notice that babies are not staring at cutlery. They're not looking at food. They're looking at faces. They stare at faces, look at face, look at face, look at face, and they stare at you. They stare at you really well. And why do they do that? They do that because they're trying to see if you're a threat or not a threat, right? And if they figured out if you're a threat or not a threat, then they're going to know, if you're a threat, I need to cry really hard because I need protection because I think you're a threat. So that's because I think that the uncanny valley is a reaction that we've learned from birth about something being a threat. And it's a very visceral reaction that we have. I find it fascinating. I actually even find it fascinating the fact that I have another hypothesis that for people that are suffering from autism, that to them, the uncanny valley is a huge zone. A lot of things look like the uncanny valley. That is why they have such a hard time understanding a relationship socially. So I think there's a relationship between autism and the uncanny valley. And that is something I think is also fascinating to study in that area of, you know, basically digital humans. So, you know, left valley, right valley. I want to know why the valley's there in the first place. And I think that's an important thing. Yes, you have one more question. And then we're going to have to wrap it up soon, guys. But
Yes, so I have a question concerning a bit what you're talking about, the uncanny valley. And it's based on an anecdote. I went to see Rogue One with my stepmother. And as I was watching the movie, there's those shot of Grand Moff Admiral Tarkin coming up. And as a Star Wars fan, I know that the actor is dead. I know that that cannot be truly him. My stepmother does not know that.
Yeah.
So at the end of the movie, she comes out, and for her, she didn't realize this was a CG character because she had no outside information that could tell her that this could be a CG character. Whereas I, at the first shot, realized that it was because I had outside information that made it that I knew it would be impossible to see this actor for real in this shot. So I'm wondering, when it comes to believability and the uncanny valley, I think there's also a lot of outdoor information that needs to come in play. And you said a lot with the talk with the Fast and Furious 7, like the fact that it wasn't marketed, that he actually didn't manage to finish the shot, I think helped a lot in selling the believability of the CG character. So concerning those experiments and those behaviors, maybe a fully digital human that is not based on an actor and that is completely created from scratch would actually be more believable to somebody because you actually don't have a reference point that know that this must be a CG character and cannot be real.
Absolutely. In fact, I don't think there's a solution to that. Like for instance, in a case like Tarkin, there's always going to be a pretty good chunk of the audience that knows that Peter Cushing is not with us, that it must be a trick, so they're going to look at it. It's going to take them out of the film. And frankly, it's a good argument for not doing it CGI and instead casting an actor to play that character instead. Now, I'm not saying we made the wrong decision, whatever. I'm just saying it's a debate, but that's a strong argument because honestly, there is no way to overcome that. There is no solution to that. And I've heard anecdotally that story many times from other people who were like, oh yeah, my family who were just sort of casual Star Wars fans but not really totally into it, it didn't bump for them. They didn't even notice it. It just like, that was just a dude in the film. But anyone who was thinking about it ahead of time, like, oh shit, that's Tarkin. Well, that can't be Tarkin. Then they're out of the movie. They're examining it and they're finding flaws and it's bugging them. So there's just, in that particular kind of case, there's simply no answer for it. But again, the funny thing is you do that in CG and everybody goes to town, like, picking the problems and noticing the things. Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill, he didn't look exactly like Winston Churchill. He looked kind of like Winston Churchill. I mean, it was a brilliant makeup job, absolutely. And I think it won the Oscar, legitimately so. But still, you look at side-by-side pictures, it's clearly two different people. But nobody complains, right? Because, you know, they know what the deal is. Oh, well, it's an actor in makeup. And it's interesting. But when you're doing it in CG, I think there's an expectation that, well, you know, you don't have the limitations of makeup. You're not working with an actor that looks kind of sort of like him. You ought to be able to get it spot on, but there's no way to get over that hump for the set, you know, the chunk of the audience that is well aware that that actor's dead and this must be a trick. There's no way around it. There's no way around it.
I wanted to just mention on the kind of like stylized versus photoreal spectrum. So in the case of General Tarkin, he has to exist in the same world as other real actors in the same shot. Yep. And so you need some kind of process that can produce something that looks consistent with the real world. So there's a need for that. I'm also totally a huge fan of The Incredibles. My God, that's like the highest form of expression of art in animation that we have today. It's worth noting that the amount of technology behind The Incredibles is also an amazing amount. There's the mathematics of perspective projection, which 95% of the time they're using the correct divide by Z, put the pixels, you know, the vertices in exactly the right place, and then sometimes they break it for artistic reasons. They are using extremely advanced global illumination path tracing algorithms with subsurface scattering, which were originally motivated for creating incredibly photorealistic images. But they've refined these techniques to the point where they've become artistic tools that people can play with the knobs and then find a way to exploit them in a stylized way that created something new and wonderful and affects us in a great way. And even though their character faces don't have really visible skin pores so much or like human facial texture, by simplifying a lot of that, they open themselves up to leave room perceptually for us to perceive a lot of kind of exaggerated motions and animations that makes those ring true in a way that we can still pay attention to that. And there's tons of magic I can't even begin to understand there, but I think it's a beautiful marriage of a lot of technology designed for realism being used to create a beautiful stylized product.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Paul. That was absolutely true. Oh, yeah, one question. One more last question. And then we're going to wrap it up. This is the last question, guys.
This question is directed at Frank and Ian. Do you feel that all these advancements in replicating a human perfectly kind of take some of your job satisfaction away? Or do you feel like these advancements will just make it a little bit easier and like do some of the heavy lifting for you?
I would just say in my opinion, it definitely takes some creativity away from the artist. Because before, you know, everyone likes sculpting, and when you can actually sculpting a good realistic human being, and people will say, wow, the likeness is great. But right now, scanner is there, and when we're doing the game, efficiency is definitely one of the first priority. That's why all the game is going more realistic in a way. Then, so right now, this is the thing, where we're going, and then, so everyone's going to scan. But our, in my opinion, it's still like I do not like make 100% one-to-one realistic human being. You know, like, and one of it just because okay. So in our game, let's say Uncharted, we have Drake, we have Sully. There's no way that we can just scan them, right? And they are the main character, they are the story, they are the main story, they are the legacy, and they have their own opinion, they have their own character that people believe. You know, I would say that who play Uncharted and who play The Last of Us, like every single one of you probably will have your own imagination of if this situation happened, what would Ellie do? If this situation happened, what would Sully do? What would Drake do? You know, all this kind of stuff. So this is the legacy part. On Uncharted 4, we did scan some human, and as we need to tie everything together, one of our way to make all the character look consistent is do hand painting texture. That's one of the way that we're trying, you know, really hard to make things cohesive, and then you know make everything tied it up in a game. So we did a lot of try, and then we did photorealistic human, using just their project texture on the top of it, and then we do, you know, do it on Drake, and it just doesn't feel right. It's really hard to get that balance. So we always wanted to put more, and this is one of the reasons that Naughty Dog basically put their own artistic feeling into this kind of pipeline. One of the most important thing is the texture part. So that's something that we constantly using to tie all the characters together, so they all feel like they are in the same universe.
Achieve the styles.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
So it sounds like some of the things that Paul was talking about, like being like making some of these things easier, so you're just turning knobs to kind of dial things in quickly rather than trying to do a bunch of sophisticated hand tweaking, help you arrive at a stylization a lot easier. So you can play artist more than technician, I guess, for lack of a better way.
Well, I think, yeah, in a way it is easier, but we're trying to make a game. To me, the game, I personally, I do not like just casting an actor and just put it in the game and make the game. To me, a game also need to be very art-related, artistic character. That's how we always, those always driving us to make the game more beautiful. And we're just basically in a pipeline, we want to think of a way to express this kind of artistic feeling to the character, and at the same time make them realistic in a way. So I think in a way, yes, it is makes it easier, but in a way it makes it even challenging, because the legacy and the skin, at the same time we need to balance it and make it, you know, consistent in game, as they all in a one universe, another challenging too. Yeah,
I pretty much agree with everything Frank said. I like scans, I like the fact that it opens doors, but it's like, my goal isn't photorealism. Like, no matter how close we get to photorealism, I will always be an artist and figure out how to add the art into it. So we can...
Sure. Mm-hmm. But I do appreciate knobs and spinners that make my life a lot easier if I want to achieve realistic skin, but maybe I want to exaggerate proportions or whatever, so...
Exactly.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, I know Ian's work and I know what he does, and the fact is, I actually got to see, you know, behind the curtain of Ian's work, because I've actually seen his shaders and his models and everything else, and Ian said the thing to me, he's like, you know, it's really not really smart. I'm not a real technician. I don't know what I'm doing. I have no, you know. And I looked at everything he did, which was very, very simple, and it was 100% correct mathematically. He just happens to know, he just doesn't know that it was there. The problem I had, which is my origin story from when we started an hour and a half ago, is that people keep messing with things, with the knobs and everything else, and that's fine if you want to stylize things and make things look like you know, The Incredibles, which I also love. I think it's cool. But when it comes to it, Ian actually does really good shaders. He just didn't overanalyze it. He just like, I just did what it came in as, and it just works, right? And it's really good. It's like really good shaders. In fact, him transitioning to another shader, which I'm going to, you know, pressure him to do because I want to see how it works for him. That's going to work for him. It's going to work for him. So I'm not saying that Ian's work isn't stylized. It is stylized, but the thing that frustrated me about when we were doing Digital Humans and people were struggling with the Uncanny Valley is that, let's take your knob example, right? Here's the valley, right? And so you're here and then you're there and you keep doing this knob. And the fact is, when it's in the valley, you go, ah, and you turn the knob too much, right? And every time you turn the knob too much, you're going out into valley every time. It's just... The valley is makes you overreact to that situation. It's very small tweaks that you need to do. And if you can remove a few knobs, it's gonna be easier for you to get there where you want it to be. So that's basically the point that I think it's important to think about. Anyway. guys, thanks so much for being here. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this talk. It's a passion of mine. I'm very passionate about this stuff. And this is a kick-ass panel on terms of this subject. Hopefully you guys agree. So thanks so much to our guests for coming to this.